Chapter 12, Interlude, On Further Reflection. One gets the impression that, far from having time on their hands, the monks of the Buddha's day were more or less fully occupied. There is a good day's work in just making one's way through a couple of sections of this teaching, considering what is involved, examining the operation of your own mind in the light of its analysis, and reflecting on your observations, let alone the lifetime's work of perfecting the practice. Once the monks had bathed, gone on their arms round, and come back, eaten and rested, the remainder of the day would have been spent in meditation. The sessions of seated practice would be interspersed with periods devoted to the regular rhythmic exercise of what is called in Pali kankamana, that is, walking up and down or ambulating, as the practice is termed in the Christian tradition. The cloisters of medieval monasteries and cathedrals were designed for this purpose. I used to do the practice myself when I lived in Kalimpong, walking up and down the veranda every evening, and sometimes after lunch as well, to avoid the drowsiness that might have set in if I had sat down to meditate. Kankamana not only provides physical exercise and relaxation, it is also a great aid to contemplation or reflection. The rhythmic quality characteristic of walking seems to be especially conducive to the purposive application of one's thinking to the investigation of a particular subject. This might be a doctrinal, philosophical, or spiritual question, or even some quite ordinary practical matter. A slow and measured walking pace seems to help to bring one's mind to bear on that point of doctrine or that practical issue, isolating it from other concerns. Kankamana, as a Buddhist practice, involves thinking of a very different kind from the aimless, more or less involuntary mental activity of ordinary daily life. One is thinking in a highly directed and specific way about the Dharma, the truth as experienced and taught by the Buddha. To be committed to this truth involves dwelling upon it in some depth, hence the importance of developing the ability to think clearly and directedly. To reflect on the Dharma is to reflect on the expression of fundamental truth in terms only barely accessible to human thought. Without intellectual clarity, we will be unable to grasp the essence of the teaching in all its subtlety and depth. If we are to practice Buddhism effectively, in short, we will need to learn to reflect. It is not easy, however, to concentrate the mind and direct one's thoughts undistractedly for sustained periods. When you are engaged in a discussion or absorbed in a book, you might be able to hold your mind to a train of thought. But if you leave it to its own devices, you are likely to find your attention wandering and your concentration starting to flag. You might set yourself to reflect undistractedly for an hour on, for instance, the three lakshanas. But it takes a lot of practice to manage more than a few minutes. Anyone who doubts this should try it and see what happens. Thinking should be under one's control, and when it isn't objectively necessary, one just shouldn't engage in it. The Buddha used to exhort his disciples to maintain a noble silence, arya mona, rather than indulge in unprofitable talk, and one could say that the same should go for thought processes. The alternative to clear and mindful thinking should not be idle mental chatter. One should be able to maintain inner silence. Again, it is obviously a lot easier to say this than to do it, but it is possible. One way to improve one's ability to think in a directed way is to plan time for thinking. One can learn to take up and put down one's thinking according to one's own needs, not just circumstances. Why not plan thinking time just as you schedule other activities? This is, in effect, a practice of sampajanya, mindfulness of purpose. We all have plenty to think about, but our trains of thought seldom reach a conclusion. We are forever dropping one thing and picking up another. Then, when we sit down to meditate, unfinished business resurfaces and hinders our concentration. Such muddled mental activity is an obstacle to action of any kind, and means that we often end up making decisions on the spur of the moment rather than thinking them through. If it is necessary to make a decision, it is best to sit down, apply oneself to the matter in hand, and come to a well-considered conclusion. But if we sit down to reflect at all, we often turn the matter over in our mind in such a half-hearted way that quite soon our thoughts have wandered away to irrelevant topics. Unable to come to any clear conclusion, we just make the decision on the basis of how we happen to be feeling at the time, or in response to some quite incidental external pressure. We cannot afford to do this if our decisions are going to count for anything. We should think about things when we have time to do them justice. Just as mealtimes, meeting friends, and making time for exercise and meditation involve making definite arrangements, mental activities can also be planned. You could apportion, say, an afternoon each week for thinking about things that really matter, things that are of much more consequence than day-to-day practicalities, although they might not be so pressing. If you keep yourself free of thinking about your deeper problems until the appointed time, you might also find everyday difficulties easier to deal with. If you try this out, though, make sure you're going to be free from interruption for however long you need, half an hour, or even weeks or months together. A chain of sustained and directed thinking can be very subtle, and to have it snapped by untimely and trivial interruptions is painful. The idea of planning in a period of thinking at 2 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon might come as a shock, but anyone with a busy life already has to do this to some extent. There are always urgent matters to attend to, but these should not be allowed to push the really important questions to the margins of our consciousness. Whether planned or not, the best way to improve one's directed thinking is simply to think more. Just as physical exercise is the way to become fit, so thinking is the way to improve the capacity for thought. It is a good idea to take any opportunity you get to consider views and opinions with a logical, questioning attitude. Reasoned discussion with a friend or in a small group, the smaller the better, gives different angles on an issue and brings an enjoyable stimulus to thinking. Because our views tend to be emotionally based, if you are thinking about something on your own, there is always the temptation to come to a premature conclusion and resist thinking upon lines that run counter to that conclusion. Collaborative thinking forces you to be more objective, to look for a truth that does not necessarily suit you. There is something about the physical presence of another person that generates interest and a keenness to get at the truth. And if you are talking with someone whose intellect is quite active, you might find that you have to get used to organizing and articulating your thoughts more carefully to avoid non sequiturs and shortcuts in your argument. Your friends might convince you or you them. You might even end up convincing yourself if you are not sure at the outset of the discussion what you really thought. Writing also helps to develop clear thinking. Your argument has to be more rigorous than when you are speaking to people you know, and you have to be more careful to make logical connections between the ideas you present. From the point of view of learning to think clearly, argument is better than agreement. If you only ever have discussions with people whose views you share and read books you agree with, you will never be obliged to address any faulty reasoning that might underpin your view of things. A valid conclusion does not guarantee the logic of any and every argument used in its support. A statement based on a poor line of argument, or no argument at all, might go unchallenged because everyone agrees with the conclusion anyway, regardless of how it is reached. It can therefore be a good idea to seek out a bit of opposition, There is nothing like meeting criticism for improving one's ability to frame a logical argument and make it watertight. Even though sound arguments are unlikely to win over someone with a deep emotional investment in the views they hold, trying to win that person over can make you aware of the strength or weakness of your logic. On the other hand, if your arguments do hold water, the confidence this gives you will help you to be more open to new ideas, because you will know that you have the ability to sift through them without getting muddled or feeling threatened. The capacity for directed thinking is a characteristic of the truly integrated personality, and the more highly developed an individual is, the more capable of sustained and directed thought he or she will be. All too often, falling back on a romantic view of how thoughts arise, people believe that there is some special faculty that makes a certain person an originator of new ideas, a genius. This idea that you've either got genius or you haven't is, of course, a convenient excuse to disguise one's unwillingness to make the effort to think things through. Genius, the old saying goes, is an infinite capacity for taking pains, and chief among the qualities of someone who has it is a sheer creative energy. When the whole person is integrated around a creative vision, the energy that arises can be tremendous. The works of Dickens, for example, a genius if ever there was one, are full of tremendous zest, and the same is true of those of Shakespeare, Mozart, Titian and Rembrandt. Another quality that marks such geniuses out as special is their refusal to be caught up in the petty details of everyday life at the expense of a higher goal. Instead, they dedicate all their energies to the production of a truly great body of work. In modern times, people seem to desire to be original at any cost, as though originality signified genius. But being different is not the same as being original. Original thought is always an extension of what has been thought by others in the past. Originality thus requires you to interpret the tradition. To do that, you need to understand it. People would often rather not acknowledge their debt to tradition. They want to start being original without troubling to master what has gone before them. But if you are really interested in a subject, you will want to know what others have had to say about it, and you might then see a way to move further in the same direction. That is the point at which original thought begins. Most of the time, of course, our thoughts and ideas are far from original. They're also far from being directed. They arise haphazardly, stimulated by random external events, and wandering from one thing to another. This kind of associative thinking does have its value. Just as your dreams, proceeding as they do by way of free association, can tell you something about yourself, so too can patterns of associative thought, if you become aware of them. One thing leads apparently arbitrarily to another, but the connection is never as arbitrary as it seems. If you allow the mind to free associate, it will still be choosing which direction it takes, though you will not be conscious of its choices. Wherever your thinking process starts, you will generally keep returning to much the same sequence of thoughts. To take the classic psychoanalytical scenario, you might find that your thoughts are always coming back to some aspect of a childhood, in one disguised form or another. And once you have realized this, you might be able to see a link between those early events and certain patterns of behavior in the present. As you begin to understand your conditioning better, you free yourself from it. Thus, associative thinking has its place in reflection, especially if you want to uncover something on an emotional level. Suppose, for example, that you are prone to anger. Rather than following a strictly logical process of deduction, you might use associative thinking to feel your way closer to the source of your problem. And we are, in a sense, thinking associatively every time we use metaphor or symbol. Literature, especially poetry, often helps us to appreciate truths that could never be fully communicated in a logical way. But you have to keep an eye on the direction in which your thought is moving, so that your associative thinking takes place within a broader sense of purpose. Despite its associative impressionistic tone, you're not merely wool gathering. It is still directed thinking in a sense, although it is being directed from a distance. Just as the recollected, purposeful aspect of mindfulness brings the mind back to the breath when you become distracted, so directed thinking brings your awareness back to the purpose of your mental activity. All your thinking should have an aim, even if that aim is sometimes best served by thinking associatively. Associative thought might help us to unearth resemblances and patterns hidden from rational thought, but this is only valuable if it helps us to arrive at a correct conclusion, that is to say, a true conclusion. Very often, associative thinking arrives at no conclusions at all. If your thinking has to lead somewhere to solve a problem or explain something to someone, the connections between your thoughts must be logical, not private, arbitrary, or symbolic, however significant the latter kinds of connection might be. If you can't put an argument together, even if you are right, you will not be able to convince anyone else that you are. It is fine to pay attention to your intuition and feelings within the context of your own reflections, but it is not so reasonable then to dress up your feelings as objective facts. When someone says, "How do you know?" it is no good replying, "Well, I just know," however confident of your knowledge you feel. Either something is capable of demonstration or it isn't. You might have a well-developed intuitive faculty which you know you can rely on, but it is unreasonable to expect someone else to accept your views simply because you feel them to be true. Of course, strong feeling has tremendous power to convince, especially if it is forcefully expressed, but it is all the more convincing if it is backed up by reason. For example, you could give a talk on compassion by evoking, in poetic and symbolic language, the figure of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva who is the embodiment of that sublime quality. You might paint a vivid and appealing picture in the minds of your audience, but your communication would only be fully effective if you were able to demonstrate that the image corresponded in some way to some external reality. Otherwise, you would be left with a kind of extraterrestrial, science fictional figure. There is, in other words, a big difference between a compelling image of the ideal and the reality of that ideal. The Christian evangelist falls into a similar trap if he opens up his Bible and says, "It must be true, it's written here." Because, of course, the fact that certain assertions are printed in a book does not prove them to be true. He will have to demonstrate that the Bible has that kind of authority, and if he cannot do so, he will have no reason to be annoyed if other people cannot accept what he says. One way to make your case is to refer to the experience of the person you are talking to. They might never have had dhyanic experience, for example, but you can give them an idea of what the dhyanas are like by referring to experiences that are familiar to them. Pleasure, for instance, is part of dhyanic experience, and everyone has experienced at least some pleasure. So if you ask the person to imagine the pleasure they have experienced magnified 10 or 20 times, they will get some sense of the intense pleasure of dhyana. Likewise, we have all experienced at least short periods of creativity and positivity. If we were to imagine that positivity continuing unbroken for a whole day at a time, what would it be like? Imagine waking up in the morning with that positive feeling already there, so that you are happy and cheerful and glad to jump out of bed and begin enjoying the day ahead. That mood would grow. You would become blissful, even rapturous, and certainly inspired. And that inspiration would have all sorts of consequences. You might be inspired to write a poem or help a neighbour or any number of things. Then imagine what those few hours of positivity would be like extended into a whole day, and another, indefinitely, into a whole lifetime, week after week, month after month of creativity, building to ever higher and more positive levels of awareness. This is the kind of life to which the Buddhist aspires. Thus, one might conclude, if one were trying to describe the goal of Buddhism in terms with which someone else could identify. Starting from an everyday experience of positivity, you would use simple logic to suggest how the state of enlightenment might be compared to it, if only very approximately. People are not always convinced by an image. Metaphor and symbol hold different associations with different people, but reason is a language we all have in common. But you don't always need to find a logical argument to show that something is true. If you have experienced the benefits of something, you can demonstrate them simply by being able to talk about them with confidence, or even just by being the way you are. For example, the fact that a Buddhist right livelihood business exists and thrives shows that it is possible to reject an economic system geared to material gain and still have a viable means of supporting oneself. If you are living contentedly in a single-sex community, this is direct evidence that true happiness does not depend on being part of a nuclear family with the statutory number of children. The reality of your life is its own argument. This was especially true of the Buddha. If someone living at the Buddha's time had said they did not believe that the enlightened state was possible, they only needed to observe the Buddha to see that it was indeed possible. His immense kindness, his intelligence, his very existence was living proof of the possibility of enlightenment. For all its subtlety and rigour, the Buddha's teaching is not in essence intellectual. For Buddhism, the heart and the mind are not separate. The term citta refers to both, so that, for example, bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, which is the central aspiration of the Mahayana tradition, is not just a thought about enlightenment in an abstract intellectual sense, but a heartfelt aspiration to emancipate oneself and all other beings from suffering. In the early Buddhist tradition, represented by such texts as the Satipatthana Sutta, wisdom is also seen not as an intellectual pursuit, but a spiritual one, to be realized through reflection, meditation, and direct experience. After all, there can be no intellectual clarity without an awareness of one's emotions. Even the most rigorously intellectual disciplines are taken up on the basis of some emotional motivation, and if this goes unacknowledged, any pretensions to rationality are vitiated from the outset. By the same token, you'll never be able to convince someone by rational argument if you fail to take their feelings into consideration. Quote, "He that complies against his will is of his own opinion still," unquote, as Samuel Butler says. This is the potential flaw in academic scholarship, even in the field known these days as Buddhist studies. Good scholarship is usually measured in terms of the strictness of its objectivity, and this is thought to mean setting aside one's own emotional responses to the material being studied. But this is not possible. There is no such thing as a pure intellectual who is not influenced by the emotions. What, after all, is the reason behind one person's choice to take up, say, Tibetology, while another chooses marine biology or nuclear physics? There is always some subjective element at work, and if it is not acknowledged, it will make its presence felt by indirect means. Indeed, there is nothing wrong with an emotionally engaged argument, so as long as those emotions are acknowledged. Problems only arise when you try to present your pet hobby horse or deeply held conviction as unbiased logical thinking. When it comes to mindfulness, what we are aiming for is an ability to think conceptually in a way that is infused with positive emotion. Thought cannot be separated from emotion. Effective thinking is wholehearted, with the whole person focused on the activity and integrated around it. Quote, a man in his wholeness, wholly attending, unquote, as D.H. Lawrence wrote. As with everything, we are looking for a middle way. We don't have to be intellectuals to be Buddhists, rather the opposite. We don't have to get bogged down in the minutiae of Abhidharma philosophy. Very often, those who make the most spiritual progress are those who concentrate on the basic teachings. But although the intellectual study of Buddhism has its limitations, we cannot afford to underestimate its importance to the cultivation of insight. Whatever aspect of the teaching we decide to focus on, we must know it and practice it thoroughly, and for this a clear understanding of the tradition is essential. There is no substitute for a committed and clear effort to think things through. Any rational grasp of truth is provisional, and we will have to venture beyond rational thinking in the end. But the end may be further away than we think.